WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Paying for a tank of gas has become a sobering experience, and it's a good reason to think more seriously about the future of oil. We rely on Saudi Arabia to keep pumping as much as we need, but some experts think that the Saudis might be reaching their peak and prove unable to keep up with the growing international demand. My guest Peter Moss is writing a book about how oil shapes global politics and the world economy. He recently visited Saudi Arabia. His article about Saudi oil, titled The Breaking Point, was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He's a contributing writer for the magazine. What questions did you set out to answer by doing this piece?
I went to Saudi Arabia to find out really how much oil Saudi Arabia has and how much it can produce on a daily level, because if you can find those answers, then you have a much better idea of whether or not, and this is kind of the big question, whether or not in the years ahead, Saudi Arabia, which is the largest oil producer, will be able to supply not just America, but the rest of the world, with enough oil to satisfy their demands on a daily basis. And there's a lot of questioning now about whether or not, in fact, Saudi Arabia can do that.
And how does the ability of Saudis to keep up with the demand for oil, how does that affect prices?
It affects prices directly because the Saudis possess about 25% of the world's known oil reserves. And they've always been kind of the central bank of oil in the sense of whenever the world needed more oil, all they did is just kind of flip a few switches and more oil came out of their wells and went into the cars of American and European consumers and factories all over the world. And so if they can't continue increasing the amounts of oil that they produce on a daily basis, then that means that really there won't be enough oil for the world, and that the price of oil as a result, when you have kind of a shortfall between demand and supply, is going to go up because the demand keeps on increasing.
When the Bush administration makes its projections for the future and what our needs will be and whether Saudis will be able to meet those needs, what are they expecting the Saudis to be able to produce in the way of oil? What are the projections that the American government is making?
In a general sense, the American government has always projected that Saudi Arabia will be able to produce as much oil as America requires. And in fact, the Saudis have always said that they will be able to produce as much oil as America and its other clients require. Right now, Saudi Arabia produces about 9.5 million barrels of oil a day. They're promising to increase their daily capacity to about 12.5 million barrels a day by the year 2009. Most people think that they probably can do that, that they can increase production to that level. The real problem is that 12.5 million barrels a day is kind of just a mark that's going to be passed in the next couple of years on a continuum, an upward continuum. And the United States government has these kind of forecasts for the year 2015, for the year 2025, in which Saudi Arabia is kind of slotted in to produce, you know, 15 million barrels of oil a day, and then up to 20, 21 million barrels of oil a day. And the problem is that most kind of responsible, knowledgeable oil experts, including some in Saudi that I talked to, say that for Saudi Arabia to produce 15 million barrels a day would really be quite taxing and may not be possible. And anything above that probably at the current moment with the technology that exists is not possible at all.
So you've sampled different opinions about what Saudis are capable of producing and how long they'll be able to keep up with need. And you found that it's actually really hard to get real answers to that question. And one has to do with it's difficult to tell how much is really in oil reserves. But the other is secrecy. Where did you run into the secrecy?
I ran smack into the secrecy when I went to Saudi Arabia. I was able to get a visa to go there, which was, you know, a minor triumph. But once I was there, I had hoped to interview officials in the oil ministry, including the minister himself, and then officials in Saudi Aramco, which is the state-owned oil company. In the end, in fact, all of my interview requests were denied by the Ministry of Oil. Nobody in the Ministry of Oil, aside from the spokesman who very reluctantly agreed to speak to me for a very short while, Really, it was pretty much of an information blockade from the Saudis because they had become incredibly sensitive to this question, to the questioning of how much oil they can produce. I mean, they see it on the one hand as being kind of a challenge to their status as the central bank of oil, and they also kind of have followed a policy, as have really all other oil producers, of not letting people know exactly what they have underground, what they are producing on a daily basis. They issue general numbers, but if you ask for the kind of information, seismological information, geological information, how much each well is producing, how much particular wells in particular fields are declining, because they all decline over time, what kinds of methods are being used to recover the oil, because you can kind of tell by the types of methods that are being used how healthy a reservoir is. All these kinds of details, which are absolutely necessary to really understanding how big reservoirs are and how long they continue going on producing oil, all of these details are basically the equivalent of state secrets in Saudi Arabia, as they are in basically all OPEC countries and among virtually all state-owned oil companies in the world.
There's an expression called peaking that's very important to what we're talking about. What does that mean?
Peak oil is kind of a phrase that you're hearing more and more in the oil world. And what it basically means, and this is kind of crucial to understanding why there are so many questions about Saudi Arabia and indeed other oil producers, what it means is that basically when a country's reserves or any particular reservoir are about half depleted, what happens is, even though there's still 50% of the oil underground that remains there, what happens is that you can no longer continue, for geological reasons basically, you can no longer continue increasing the amount that you extract from the reservoir, because oil reservoirs are not like kind of, you know, lakes of oil underground with which these wells are like straws that you suck the oil out of. In fact, oil really exists as little drops between and within porous rocks. It's extremely difficult, actually, to extract from these reservoirs. And when you reach this halfway point with about roughly half of the oil out of a particular reservoir, at that point, and this is where this phrase peak oil comes in, you're no longer going to be able to continue increasing the amount of oil on a daily basis that you produce from this reservoir. And the kind of question that exists right now, and there are a number of people who suggest this, including a Houston energy banker named Matt Simmons, the question really is, have Saudi Arabia's reservoirs peaked? Are they just about at the point where they can no longer produce increasing amounts of oil? And there's real kind of reason to at least look into it, if not believe that.
And Matthew Simmons, who you just referred to, he's the head of a company that advises energy companies on mergers and acquisitions. And what is he projecting about when the Saudi oil is going to peak?
Well, Matt Simmons suggests in this new book that he just published that basically Saudi Arabia is probably peaking right now. And Matt Simmons is quite an interesting situation because he is, you know, he's not some kind of wild environmentalist or kind of rogue economist or anything like that. I mean, he is part of kind of the ruling class of the oil world. He's an energy banker in Houston, very prosperous. And he went to Saudi Arabia in 2003 on a government-sponsored tour, kind of thing that the Saudi government throws all the time for investors and bankers. And instead of actually coming out of that visit really impressed with the Saudi oil industry, he had questions. And he couldn't get them answered by the Saudis or anybody, really. And so what he did is he looked into kind of these files that exist of kind of technological papers that have been written about some of the Saudi oil fields that nobody really paid any attention to. And he examined these, about 200 papers about the Saudi oil fields. He examined them, and he kind of came to the conclusion that, in fact, these fields are not in nearly as good health as the Saudis say. And he came out with a conclusion that the Saudis have attacked quite strongly, that in fact Saudi Arabia is peaking right now. And because Saudi Arabia is peaking, that means basically the world is probably at its peak, because Saudi Arabia, with a quarter of the world's oil reserves, pretty much determines where everything else is going as well.
So you've got one oil expert saying that the Saudi oil has already peaked. You've got another who used to be highly placed in the state Saudi company Aramco saying hasn't peaked yet, but likely will soon. And then you've got the Saudis themselves, the officials, saying, "Oh no, everything's great." So, how do you decide where the truth lies?
Well, you've got to look, you know, as with kind of you know, all matters, whether economic or political, at what kind of the interests and incentives are of each side to maybe, you know, color their conclusions or their public statements. And the Saudis are in a real bind because, let's say, for example, that indeed there are limits to what they can produce. If they just all of a sudden announce to the world, you know what, guys, we're not going to be able to produce more than 12.5 million barrels a day. You're going to have to develop alternative energy sources. You're going to have to start conserving energy. Then two things are likely to happen, at least in the immediate term. One is that the price of oil, which is already quite high, will skyrocket even more. And the second, and for the Saudis, more troubling kind of result would be that indeed there would be movements in America and elsewhere towards alternative fuels, government programs to investigate, to promote them. There would be movements towards conservation of energy. And the result of that, not immediately, but, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, is that there very well indeed might be alternatives to oil. And the Saudis, who, you know, depend on income from oil to keep their country and their economy afloat, may no longer have this valuable resource that can't be replaced because there may be replacements for it. So they don't want to kind of kill the goose that lays the golden egg by telling people, hey, the golden eggs may no longer be there in a couple of years.
My guest is Peter Moss. His article about Saudi oil was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Moss. He's writing a book about how oil shapes global politics and the world economy. His article about Saudi Arabia's oil and whether it can keep meeting our demands was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. You say it might take 10 years to prepare for a time when oil demand exceeds oil output. Congress just passed a new energy bill. What does that bill set in motion to help prepare for oil problems in the future?
Most of the people who I've talked to about the energy bill and how well it kind of begins to prepare us for the future tend to agree that the energy bill really does very little to prepare America for a future in which there might be shortages of oil. Because really there are kind of two key things that need to happen. Pretty much everyone that I've talked to agrees on, which is that there needs to be more conservation of the way that we consume oil. And there also needs to be more development and really assertive development of alternative fuels. I mean, of course, there are alternatives that exist, but they haven't been proven yet to be economically viable, or if they have become proven to be economically viable, they haven't been scaled out to the size that's necessary for them to play a major role. And the energy bill really doesn't go very far in that. On just the issue of, for example, conservation, really, you know, everybody who you would talk to in the energy world agrees that one of the key things that America needs to do is increase the fuel efficiency of its automobile fleet. And the one thing that is actually lacking from the energy bill that was just signed by the president is an increase, a mandated increase in the fuel efficiency standards for American cars. That was one measure that everybody was saying, look, you know, it would make a great amount of sense to do. Does not exist in the energy bill. Another kind of, you know, reform that a lot of people think is necessary, which would be very painful for Americans, is that the price of gasoline would need to rise in order to indeed promote conservation by virtue of taxes on gasoline, greater taxes than exist now. Americans pay maybe half of what Europeans pay for gasoline. You know, a gasoline tax is something that really is you know, one of the many third rails that exist in American politics. In the presidential campaign in 2004, President Bush accused John Kerry of being in favor of gasoline taxes. You know, Kerry was not in favor of gasoline taxes during this campaign at all, even though, you know, many people say that's exactly the kind of hard medicine that America needs to begin to swallow.
How could a gasoline tax help conserve energy?
Well, a gasoline tax has a very straightforward effect on energy conservation. If you make gasoline more expensive for people to consume, they're going to probably consume less of it. You know, already at nearly $3 a gallon in some places, gasoline is quite expensive. If you, you know, slap an additional tax on it, it's going to become more expensive and people will drive less. That's going to make their lives a little bit more difficult, particularly for people who really rely on their cars. If you live in the suburbs, if you're a trucker, things of that sort, it's very painful. But it's also something that would lead to greater conservation. And that's why there's a fair number of people who think that it's something that should be done. But it is indeed extremely difficult for any politician in America to really aggressively promote it. Because, you know, one of the last people who did aggressively promote conservation measures and painful ones for this country was Jimmy Carter, who called for the moral equivalent of war. in order to make America free of dependence for oil from foreign sources. And of course, we all know what happened to him. You know, he was not reelected. There were many reasons why he was not reelected, but a large number of people do believe that some of the reasons he was not elected was because indeed he was calling for national sacrifice in the way of energy conservation that people just did not want to have in their lives.
When President Bush talks about our oil future, he talks about the need to drill in the Alaska a National Wildlife Refuge. How much would that add to the oil that we have access to?
The Alaskan Wildlife Refuge has, nobody knows exactly, but a rough figure that people agree on is about 10 billion barrels of oil. Not insignificant, but when you compare it to, for example, to Saudi Arabia, which has reserves of about 260 billion barrels of oil, it's pretty small stuff. Now, because it's unlikely that vast new reservoirs of oil are going to be found anywhere in the world, reservoirs that contain 10 billion barrels of oil are going to have to be part of the solution, interim solution at least. If you need more oil and, you know, there are only little 10 billion barrel fields here or there, most people will say, well, then that's what you got to go with. Now, you know, of course, the 10 billion barrels that we're talking about are in Alaska. They're in a wildlife refuge, and there are very good reasons to not drill there. One of the things that some people have pointed out to me, and I've traveled around and visited a lot of oil sites in Africa and elsewhere, is that there are a lot of nice tracts of land in Amazon countries, in Ecuador and Brazil, in African countries that I've been to, in Nigeria, the Niger Delta, which used to be just an amazing, amazing source of wildlife, that have been and that are being affected quite severely. And, you know, one of the kinds of interesting and less talked about aspects of the debate about the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge is if we don't get the 10 billion barrels of oil from there, it's going to come from somewhere else. And in some respects, you're kind of exporting the problem or outsourcing the environmental problem, because there are very few places on the planet where oil exploration is conducted where there is not environmental damage of, in many cases, environments that are quite precious. And so, you know, personally, I just wish people kind of understood that a bit more.
I know a lot of people wonder, do the high prices of gas and oil today have anything to do with the war in Iraq? Is there any evidence that there's a connection between the two?
Oh, well, there's definitely a connection between the two, because, you know, one of the hopes in terms of the effects of the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, would be that after Saddam was thrown out, there would be a lot of investment in the Iraqi oil industry. And Iraq has something like 110 billion barrels of oil underground. And Iraqi oil production would just, you know, double or triple or something like that. If that had been the case, maybe we'd be in a slightly, or we should be in a slightly better situation right now in terms of the amount of oil that would be available and the price. But because that's not the case, because in fact, after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the production of oil in Iraq, you know, kind of has been just limping along and hasn't really returned to its previous levels, let alone kind of increasing above them. We're in the situation now where you know, there's a shortage, and where Iraq is in some respects part of the problem, in the sense of not being able to produce the amounts of oil that the rest of the world wants. And nobody thinks that that's going to change anytime soon. You know, even if tomorrow Iraq turned into a peaceful country where there could be kind of productive investment and new exploration, it would be years and years before any of that would result in really greatly added amounts of oil coming out of the ground. It takes, you know, projects in the oil industry to kind of from start to finish, from when you start drilling to when you actually get oil out of the ground and send it through pipelines. So those are usually projects that take years and years and you know, billions and billions of dollars.
What kind of national conversation do you think we need to be having about the future of oil, the future of our oil use?
I think the conversation that needs to happen needs to focus on the fact that the time when the amount of oil that we're going to need on a daily basis very likely will not be available, we need to focus on that issue and know that in order to prepare for that moment, we probably have to start now, because developing and scaling out alternative energy sources, whether they're environmentally friendly, you know, solar power, wind power, whatever, or whether they're not environmentally friendly, nuclear power, the scaling out needs to begin now, because even if this point when there's not enough oil on a daily basis to supply our increasing demands, even if this is 15 years off, it's going to take 15 years to prepare for that. And if we don't prepare for that, we're going to be facing an incredibly painful time where the situation that prevailed in 1973 when there was a boycott by the Arab members of OPEC, that situation, painful as it was, will probably seem like, you know, a mere pinch compared to what would happen if there were not enough oil, not just for a temporary period of time, but for time until there's no more oil left at all. We probably need to begin preparing for that now.
Peter Moss, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Moss's article about Saudi oil was published in yesterday's New York Times Magazine. He's writing a book about oil. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.